Back in chapter 35, it ended by telling us that Isaac had died at the age of 180 after it had told us that Jacob had moved his family to Hebron to live with Isaac and to live with Esau, who had moved his family there also. And so the family was all together at the end of chapter 35, and Moses chose fit in writing this at the age of 82, the book of Genesis, and putting it all together to us to go ahead and sum up the life of Isaac and tell us that he would live to be 180. And that when he died, his sons Jacob and Esau would bury him in the same cave that Abraham and Sarah were buried in. Now, as I told you then, Isaac actually had not died yet in time, and I showed you that. In fact, even here in the lesson today, chapter 37, Isaac still will live for 13 more years past today's lesson. But the purpose of what Moses was doing was must have been to sum up the life of Isaac so they would not have to speak about him again. And then in last week's lesson, Moses chose fit to show us the life and the heritage and the descendants of Esau, all the way down to the descendants of Esau who were in charge of the land of Edom when Moses were leading the people out of Egypt into the promised land and during their time there in the wilderness. And so he summed up the life of Esau in chapter 36. And so as we look here in chapter 37, now what is happening after Isaac's life has been summed up, and then he went back and he summed up Esau's life. Now he's going to come back to the same starting point. The year is 2,259 years after the creation of Adam. Joseph, he's telling us, Joseph is 17 years old. Now, I've been telling you that for weeks, that we knew that when Joseph was sold into Egypt, he is 17 years old. That's finally arriving here in this lesson. Now, let me go ahead and tell you a little more just so that you get it. I've discovered that if I go ahead and tell y'all stuff ahead of time, then you catch it whenever I show it to you when it shows up. Later on, we're going to find out that Joseph is 39 years old when he moves the family to Egypt. Well, if Joseph is 17 years old now, and when he's 39, we know that Jacob was 130. That's how we get that Jacob was 91 years old when Joseph was born, because he moves to Egypt at 130 minus Joseph's age of 39. We have 91. You see that? So we know when Joseph is 17 years old that Isaac hasn't died yet. In fact, Isaac is going to live on until just before Jacob moves to Egypt. So Isaac's going to live another 22 years. So as we pick up here, it says, "Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan." So finally what we've got here is we've got Jacob home with his father Isaac. We've got Esau home with his father Isaac. Even though last week's lesson, the previous chapter, told us that while Esau was living with Jacob and Isaac, his father, there came a time when the land could not hold and sustain all the livestock, that Esau made the decision to move on down back into the mountains of Seir, where he had once lived before. He had lived there whenever Jacob was coming out of Haran, and then when finally he moved back to Hebron to live with his father Isaac, and Jacob comes down and lives with his father Isaac also. So they're all living together. So as we pick up here in verse 2, it says, "Now these are the records of the generations of Jacob." Now, every time we have seen that before, we get ready for a list of genealogy, okay? That's not what Moses does here. What Moses does is Moses turns directly to the generations of Jacob and how they relate to Joseph. So he says, "Joseph, when 17 years of age," there we've got it, black and white right for you, "was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth." You notice it says youth? That's interesting, because 17 years old was not a youth for those. in those days. They were considered men at 17 years old. Evidently, what Moses is trying to say to us, that he was still a young man who probably always didn't make the right decisions at this point in time. After all, you know, the smartest men we know are those who made a whole lot of mistakes early. Those who, you know, you learn from your mistakes or someone else's mistakes. Well, Joseph's going to make some. He's going to make some good ones today. And so he says that he was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpha, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now, not that it matters, but did you notice that he was not pasturing the flock with all of his brothers? He was only pasturing the flock with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpha. Now, what does that mean? That means he was pasturing and the flock with his half-brothers named Gad, Asher, Issachar, and Zebulun. I'm sorry, Gad, Asher, Dan, and Naphtali. I knew I said that wrong. Gad, Asher, Dan, and Naphtali. Evidently, Dan, Asher, Gad, and Naphtali wasn't doing something right. They weren't doing things probably the way that Father would have liked them to do, and Joseph knew it. So Joseph, as it says here in the text, decided that he would tell Dad what was going on. Tell Dad what was going on. You know, we don't live in an age today where people are willing to tell people the truth. Did you know that? We're not living in an age. In fact, people think that people who tell them the truth are harsh people, are people who are mean people, because they're telling the truth. They're telling the truth. This week I had an opportunity with a person who bothered me greatly, and I was listening to her speak, and she was saying things such as, "Well, you know, what is true to me and another, what is true for you may not be true for me, and what is true for me may not be true for you." Now, I want you to know something, folks. Truth is either truth or it's not truth. It's either true or false. So if you're 30 years of age or under, you may be living in a politically correct lifestyle that says, okay, so what is true for you may not be true for me, and what is true for me may not be true for you. So I asked her, do you believe in moral good and moral bad things? And she said, well, let me think about that. And I said, well, don't you have some things innately in you that just swell up that are God-given that says that is right or that is wrong? And she said, well, I don't know. I said, well, let me help you with this. Let me just throw one out there and just, you know, I'm going to throw her a softball. I mean, one that anybody can hit. I said, do you believe that it is wrong to murder, to take an innocent person's life, to murder? Well, I don't know. I said, you don't know whether it's right or wrong to take someone's life? I said, okay, well, let me make it a little easier for you since you've got a brand new child there, your baby that you have there. I said, do you think it is right for, say, you hire a babysitter and that babysitter takes cigarettes and lights the cigarettes and starts branding your baby with a cigarette? Don't you think that's right or wrong? Does that stir up any sense? Well, I wouldn't want that to happen to my child, but, you know, I'd have to think about it for others. I go, what is going on? What is, either it is right or it is wrong. So I said to her, I said, so let me just throw you a third one. I said, so do you tolerate the belief in homosexuality? And she says, yes, I do. And I said, so then you disagree. You agree with me that homosexuality is wrong. She says, no, that's not what I said. I said, yes, it is. Because you remember, to tolerate means that you disagree with it, but you will put up with it. If you agree that homosexuality is correct, you agree with it. To tolerate means that there is something that you disagree with. So in this world of hers where she is wanting everybody to be tolerant, that means putting up with something that you disagree with. You understand that? So the opposite is true. And I said, I got to come down to you. I said, okay, so you just now got that one. So you understand what is home. I said, so if your baby was in the next room and somebody was hurting your baby, what I'd probably call the police. Okay, why? Because that's wrong for my baby. I said, so evidently there's something right for you and maybe not for somebody else. And she said, yes. And I said, listen, I've got to ask you something. I said, it is wrong to murder and it is wrong to hurt a baby. And she said, well, who are you to judge? And I said, do you realize that you just judged me by asking me who are you to judge? Because she made a judgment about me and asked the question, who are you to judge? Do you realize how that's self-refuting, how it cuts against itself? And I said, okay, either true is true, good is good, and bad is bad, or there is no truth. And she said, well, you know, she said, not everything, there's not truth about everything in this world. And I said, do you realize what you just said to me? Did you realize that if you say that there's not everything true, there's nothing, actually she said there's nothing true in this world. I said, do you realize that because you said there's nothing true in this world, that statement that you just said to me cannot be true. It must be false, because even that statement is false. Because you said there's nothing true in this world. And so I've got her going. I do have her going. I said, you cannot even believe in a God. You cannot believe in the truth of the Word of God and the things about it if you hold on to this notion that there's nothing true in this world, and that you don't want to hurt anybody's feelings by telling them the truth. By telling the truth. One of the biggest statements, the most commonly made statements when people come to my office is, they will come in and will say, so-and-so told me that if I wanted to hear the truth, that you would tell me the truth, and that I am... my candor is very straightforward, and it is. It is very straight. I'm going to tell you what I believe to be true. And you can probably take it to the bank. In fact, if I tell you it's Easter, you better buy a basket. Because it's Easter's coming up. Whether you want to accept it or deny it or not, that's just the way I have positioned myself. That I am not worried about whether I am offending anybody as long as I am leading people to Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. Because I want you to know something. My Lord and Savior was the most offensive person in the entire Word of God. David was not offensive. Joseph was not offensive enough. Jacob was absolutely a mansy-pansy. He wasn't offensive about anything. Esau wasn't offensive. Abraham wasn't offensive. But my Jesus was offensive. Do you know how I know? Because at every turn, my Jesus, my Lord and my Savior was offending someone, and they were running to tell the priest about it. Or they were running to tell the Pharisees about it. In fact, my Jesus offended this world so much that they hung him on a cross. But they hung him on a cross for him to die at his own choosing, because right is right and wrong is wrong. Joseph had every right to go to his father and say, your sons are not doing right. That was one check against Joseph, because those four sons told their other brothers, and their other brothers picked up the offense. And in picking up that offense, it made them mad at Joseph, almost to the point where they couldn't even talk to him. In fact, that's what's going to be said in the next passage. It says, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Have any of y'all ever had someone in your life that did something that caused you not to even to be able to say a word to them, at least for a while? You just were so mad at them. There's nothing wrong with being mad. There's nothing wrong with being angry. Now, what you do with it can be right or wrong, but if someone makes you angry, there's nothing wrong with that. And some of us have people in our lives that have made us so angry that we just didn't even know what to say to them, and we couldn't talk to them on friendly terms because anything we would say to them just wouldn't come out right. Have any of y'all had somebody like that in your life? Okay, now the rest of you are lying. Okay, because you have. I promise you, you have. Now, it just, they've made you so mad. You cannot speak to them on friendly terms. Oh, you may do some talking, but it won't be friendly. Now, some of you have been maybe saying the truth back to them because they made you mad and you said the truth. But that doesn't mean it's friendly terms just because you tell them the truth, because the truth hurts. The truth is often and is most of the time offensive. People do not want to hear the truth. The truth. People plug in words that do not belong. Plug in words that do not belong in their sentences. I heard one this morning. I went home to get my wife and my family to bring them back to church. And while I went there, I was listening to a radio station. And on that radio station, they were talking about our president and things that he said off the cuff before he became the president. And those things that he said off the cuff, they said were dangerous statements to the security of our nation. And everything that he said off the cuff, they thought was off the cuff, are the things that he is now enacting for us that we voted for him for. You got that? It's the things we voted for him for those of us who voted for him. I guess you know who I voted for now. Those are the things that they're saying those were dangerous and that he is a dangerous man. And they even used the word that he was a sociopath. Those are words they add in to make you feel bad. But listen, here's the deal. The deal is he is doing exactly what he promised us he would do. And whether we like it or not, we have 4 years now to put up with this, and we can change it 4 years from now. But he is doing and protecting for us what needs to be done. No longer are we calling it ISIL. We're calling it ISIS across the board. I don't know if you've seen that. The order has gone out for that. Because it is not, the word ISIL means the Islamic State that should be living in Israel. That's what that L means, okay? But with ISIS, it means the Islamic State of Syria up there. You see, our former administration believed that Syria should have been in control of all of that land that we call Israel. And so that's one of those little hidden things that most people didn't know about what those words meant. If you're a terrorist, you're a terrorist. Well, Joseph here has spoken the truth. And Joseph has also become 17. Now, I'm sure that whenever Jacob was living down in Beersheba that he had never seen, because they were not on the main trade route, he had never seen the deal about when you're 17 years old giving a white robe to the favorite son. But when he moved to Haran, now he is on the trade route, and all those in Syria, which is where Haran is, and in Persia, and in Babylon, and in India, the favorite son of a family was given a white robe at the age of 17. I want you to hear what I just said. You, just because you were a son did not mean you got a white robe at the age of 17. The favorite son got a white robe at the age of 17. And so you may be the oldest, you may be the youngest, or you may be one in between. And so Jacob, when he's living in Haran, has seen these caravans of folks coming through. And when a 17-year-old or older is wearing a white tunic, I should say, everyone knew that that was the favorite son of that family. Now, I got news for you. Being the favorite son is not always the best thing to be. Being the favorite at anything is not always the best thing to be. And on top of that, Jacob, by giving this very colored tunic, which means it was more expensive than just a white tunic. It was a more special than just a white tunic. It means that Jacob was flaunting that Joseph was the favorite son. Why was Joseph the favorite son? Because he was one of the two sons of his favorite wife, Rachel. You follow me? Now, we got a problem with that. We've got a problem with that. His brothers noticed that he was the favorite son, and they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Who should have his brothers been upset with? Joseph or Jacob? Jacob, you agree. We all know that. But that's not the way children show their anger. They always show it to their siblings. In fact, let's just spread it out to classrooms where there's the favorite teacher's pet. Teacher's pet. Who gets the brunt? The child. Who did the wrong? The teacher. You're exactly right. And so Jacob has done a wrong to Joseph by giving him this coat of many colors, this very colored tunic. And the brothers take it out on Joseph. Now, there's another brother, Benjamin, already, okay? I mean, we've got this deal going on here. We've got Benjamin also. But Joseph was the favorite because he was the son that was born first, the firstborn of Rachel. So, Joseph doesn't know any better. He's getting the brunt of it. Look what happens in verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brother said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Well, he offended the first four who told their brothers, and so all their brothers is picking up the fence. Then daddy comes along and gives his robe, and so it's nanny, nanny, boo, boo, daddy's pet, daddy's pet, daddy's pet, daddy's pet. And now Joseph has a dream, and he doesn't have the wherewithal to understand that some dreams and some things you think need to not be spoken. Some things just need to be left alone. But no, Joseph just spurts it out. "Hey, brothers, guess what? I had this dream, and we were out cutting sheaves. And as we were cutting sheaves, mine stood up erect and y'all's came around and bowed down to me." I don't think that would go over very well in my family either if my sister came in and announced to me that she was taking over the family or whatever and was going to be the first in charge. Well, Reuben was there. Judah was there. Issachar was there. Simeon was there. Levi was. What about them? They're all older. Remember, Reuben, the oldest, is at least 13 years older than Joseph this time. Joseph's 17. Judah's 30. Reuben is 30. And all the rest of them come somewhere in between. We're talking about adults here. So Joseph doesn't learn his lesson. It says verse 9. Now he had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And he related it to his father and to his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" He just asked the question. And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. There's the first plant. The first plant of a little seed there. Jacob is going to keep what has been said in mind. You know, Joseph has had these two dreams. We must remember that his father also had dreams. His father also dreamed of a stairway that went to heaven and came back down to earth with angels going up and coming down, and a promise made to him that the Lord would be with him and the Lord would bless him, and the Lord had fulfilled that promise. So Jacob cannot just dismiss these two dreams that his son has had. Mary could not dismiss the things that were happening to her child and were happening to him when he was there and a teenager that had been left behind, and he says to her, "I must be about my father's business." Mary is pondering all these things that are being said about him through the years, and she's pondering things that are happening during her ministries and keeping them in mind and placing them in her heart and soul. And I could show you many other times through the Old Testament where the parents and other people are remembering the things that have been said, because these are prophecies that are going to be fulfilled. Now, the prophecy to Abraham has already begun to be fulfilled through Joseph and through Jacob, and then through Joseph again, and through all the brothers and the sisters. And now we have two more. These two prophecies that are right here, in the dream of the sheaves and the dream of the sun, the moon, the stars, they're going to be fulfilled 22 years after this date. 22 years from this happening, they're going to be fulfilled, and their brothers and their father will understand that. Verse 12 says, "Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem." What in the world are they doing up in Shechem? I'll tell you in a minute. "And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them.' And he said to him, 'I will go.' And then he said to him, 'Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flocks, and bring word back to me.' So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him there, behold, and he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, 'What are you looking for?' And he said, 'I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock.' And then the man said, 'They have moved from here, for I heard them say, "Let us go to Dothan."' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan." This passage is very interesting. So what has happened here? We'll look up at the map that I've got drawn on the board. They're down in Hebron. They have gone to feed their flocks 40 miles away in Shechem. Evidently, we do not know how long they were there, but they were not there very long, because probably the land could not sustain them. And so they moved on 20 more miles to Dothan. And so Joseph has been sent, and he's landed 60 miles away to go to Dothan. And there Dothan, which is on the major trail routes, the trade routes that come all the way from India and Persia and all that to go to Egypt, that is a part of the trail route as they come down through Gilead and come over down to Dothan and on down into Egypt. Let me tell you what I believe has happened here. I believe that they have had to send their flocks to Shechem to graze the flocks, because the land in Hebron cannot sustain all the flocks of Isaac, all the flocks of Esau, and all the flocks of Jacob, because they're living together. And Jacob owns all that land in Shechem that he bought for 100 head of sheep. And so that land belongs to him still. And so he sent his flocks to be fed there. But when Joseph lands there, the land is not sustaining those flocks. And so they have moved on to free graze 20 more miles away in Dothan. And so Joseph is on his way to Dothan to find them. And he is going to find them there. And the reason why I think I know that is in last week's lesson, but it's here, I've got it here in Genesis chapter 36, verse 6 says, "Then Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the household and his livestock and all his cattle and all his goods which he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to another land away from the brother Jacob, for their property had become too great for them to live together, and the land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock." So I think what has happened is Jacob is checking on the welfare of what is going on in Shechem. They're not going to end up in Shechem. They're going to end up in Dothan. But what has happened is Esau now, according to about this time, has moved back down to the mountains of Seir, where he was living whenever Jacob was up in Haran. You remember when Jacob came down from Haran, Esau came up from the mountains of Seir to meet him and then went back to the mountains of Seir. And over that next time slot period, Esau moved to be with dad. Jacob finally landed to be with dad, and they're all trying to live together, but the land just cannot sustain them. So Esau's moved away, and now it's time to check in on the flocks for Jacob and to find out whether it's okay. We'll let the land graze just a little bit, and then we'll bring those flocks back down to Hebron. That's probably what was the intention. Verse 18 says this, "And when they saw him from a distance," that's when the brothers saw Joseph coming, "and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. Four strikes were against him, and they wanted him dead." Just seeing him come, they did not want to give him the fifth opportunity to make them mad at him again. So while he's still in a distance, they plot to put him to death. "And they said to one another, 'Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Let him see what will, then let us see what will become of his dreams.'" Actually, the Hebrew, I like it better. The Hebrew actually says, "Here comes the master of dreams," or it could be said the master dreamer. Here comes the guy who dreams these dreams that are always good for him. Got these grandiose dreams, royalty and all of that. Let's put him to death, throw him in a pit and see what happens to his dreams then. Well, Reuben speaks up. Reuben's the oldest. Now remember, Reuben's got a problem with dad. Do you remember what the problem with dad is? Reuben had had an improper relationship with Rachel's maid after Rachel died. Do you remember that? And Jacob didn't say much. He just thought about it. Well, we know what he's going to think about it, because in chapter 49, which we're not there yet, but I am. I've already been there. Chapter 49, Reuben is not going to get the blessing of being that should have come to the firstborn. That's going to be stripped away from him because of what happened with Rachel's maid, Bilhah. Reuben sees this opportunity with Joseph as a way to redeem himself in his father's eyes. And so what does Reuben say? "But Reuben heard this and rescued him out." Reuben heard this and rescued him out of... I lost my place, okay? I was doing that by memory. I guess I ought to stick to the script here. "But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, 'Let us not take his life.' Reuben further said to them, 'Shed no blood. Throw him into the pit, into this pit in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father.'" So Reuben has said, "I got this plan. Okay, you want to kill him? I don't want to kill him. Let's don't kill him. He's our brother. He's our blood. Let's don't kill him. Let's throw him into the pit. Now what will happen is I'm going to leave. And when I come back after y'all thrown him in the pit, I'm going to rescue him out of the pit. Now he's not going to know that I don't know that he's supposed to be thrown into the pit. But when I get back here, I'm going to rescue him out of the pit. I'm going to get Joseph up. We're going to go to dad. I'm going to say, 'Look, dad, I rescued Joseph out of the pit,'" trying to redeem himself for what he had done before. Verse 29, Moses, for some reason, tells us the end of the story before he actually tells us about Joseph finally getting there for it to happen. Here we go. Verse 29 says, "Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. So he tore his garment, and he returned to his brothers and said, 'The boy's not there. As for me, where am I to go? What am I to do? I'm the oldest. I'm supposed to be in charge.'" In fact, whoever the oldest was that went out on any tour, if it had been three brothers, the oldest of the brothers would always be responsible for the rest of them. That's just their culture. Whoever the oldest was, they're responsible. Reuben was the oldest. He's responsible. Now he says, "What am I supposed to do? I had this plan put in place where I was going to redeem myself, and now I've showed up at the pit to pull him out, and the boy's not there. Where is this boy? Reuben is 30 years old. Joseph was supposed to be 17, and he can't pull him up out of the pit. Where's the boy? What am I going to do? What am I going to say to Dad now? What am I going to do? This is just going to make my relationship with Dad worse. You can just spin all that out all day long. Linear thinking, A to B to C to D. We all have lived in families long enough to know how these things go bad fast. Go bad fast. Okay, so now we've got to back up. Moses is doing a lot of telling, and then he backs up and says, now it's time for Joseph to actually show up. You got that? We know the ending, but now Joseph is fixing to show up. Verse 23. So it came about that when Joseph reached his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and they threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. In other words, they're going to punish this boy. That's what they're going to do. They're going to punish him. And so they've got the colored tunic and they've got him in the pit. Reuben's gone off somewhere. Remember that? I know he's already returned previous. We already know that. But Reuben's actually gone at this point in time because they've got him in the pit. He's just showed up. And I tell you what, this bothers me when I know people who are like this. They do something dirty. They do something evil to someone. They do something to someone that they do not, that person does not deserve it. And then what do people who do those things do? Verse 25. Then they sat down to eat a meal. Does that just not pause for you to go, boy, they were mad at him. They didn't care about him one bit. They set him down, put him in that pit, and set. Joseph has evidently showed up at lunchtime and interrupted their lunch. So they threw him into the pit, and then they went to eat. And I bet you all those brothers ate more than they usually did, because I don't think they backed up on it one bit. Goes on. And as they were eating, as they raised their eyes and looked up, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, and on their way to bring them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, Judah said this. You got this? Huh. Judah's not the oldest. Judas is the fourth child of Jacob. So he's not taking the lead. Simeon ought to be taking the lead, but Simeon's not taking the lead. Judah's taking the lead. Levi could have been taking the lead, but because it's Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. That's the order. Judah's speaking up. And what brute Judah is fixing to say is going to haunt him for the next 22 years. And when we finally get down to that chapter where the sons, let's put it, the sheaves of the sons are bowing to the sheave of Joseph in Egypt, it is going to be Judah that's doing the talking. Because Judah is the one that's going to be retelling this terrible story about what just happened right here. And he's going to tell it twice to Joseph. And Joseph knew it because he was there living it. And Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and to cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they came up to him and lifted Joseph up out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now there's, well, tell you what just happened, okay? The Ishmaelites had already become the caravan people. Different groups of people, whoever you were, would pay the Ishmaelites to run the caravan to protect the group as they would take all these precious gifts and supplies to different places, and they would go in caravans. And the Ishmaelites were the owners of the caravans. Now, just so you understand, this didn't change a whole lot. The Ishmaelites started doing this, And way on later down, another, let's see how many years, 2,000 years almost, no, another 2,500 years, there's another Ishmaelite who was the owner of a caravan who got sideways with the Christians and the Jews and started his own religion called Islam. Got it? Ishmaelite caravan owners. I want to remind you who Ishmael is. Ishmael is Jacob's uncle. Got that? Ishmael is the half-brother of Isaac, Jacob's father. And by this time, this has gone down, so these people in charge of this caravan, the Ishmael caravan, are the grandsons of Ishmael. And these are the grandsons of Isaac. So let's just make sure we understand. These are second cousins to each other. You follow me? Second cousins. Ishmaelites, Jacobites, Israelites, okay? Second cousins, that's where we are. Who are the Midianites? Midian was the fourth child of Abraham by Keturah. Abraham gave all of his sons by Keturah, a large gifts when they became of age, and sent them out to develop their own tribes to be nations. So the Midianites were... Midian was a half-brother of Ishmael, who was a half-brother of Isaac. Did you just catch this? Okay. So we have the grandsons of the descendants of Abraham here. Got that? The grandsons of they're all second cousins to each other. They're second cousins. Okay. Just so you got it. Abraham had Ishmael. Abraham had Isaac. Abraham had Midian. They all developed tribes, grandsons. Got it? The Ishmaelite grandsons are running the caravan. The Isaac grandsons, got that? The Isaac grandsons have their brother in a pit. And the Midianite grandsons are going to pull him up out of the pit and be part of buying it, because the Midianites are moving goods and being protected by their cousins, the Ishmaelites. You following all this? These are cousins against cousins. And they're second cousins. Some of my best relatives are my second cousins. I don't know what the deal was, but there is a hatred going on here. And so Judah sees them, they pick him, and for 20 shekels they sell Joseph to their cousins, who are then going to just go on down in traipse, on down through the land, and go to the capital city of Egypt. So the Ishmaelites and the Midianites have come from India, Persia, and all that. They're on the caravan. They're coming down the road, the major trade route. They go through Dothan. They pick up Joseph. They pay 20 shekels for Joseph. And then they go 110 more miles down to Zoan. Zoan is the same capital city as the town called Tanis. Tanis and Zoan. So if you've watched any of the Indiana Jones movies and that type of stuff, and you hear the word Tanis. Tanis is the capital city of Egypt. It is right on the edge of the land of Goshen. You got that? Land of Goshen. Why is that? Because the land, this is all fresh water running down the Nile River. By the way, the Nile River runs from the south to the north. We always think, because in America, almost all the rivers run from the north to the south. But over here, the Nile River is running from the mountains down this way, goes to this delta. And the luscious part of Egypt that is all, you can always grow a crop, no matter what's happening in any of the rest of Egypt, always in Goshen you can grow a crop. And the capital city of Egypt was right there on the edge of Goshen. The beautiful water of the Mediterranean was just above it there, and this beautiful water coming down. Now, the capital city of Egypt now is Cairo, and Cairo is down here, further on down into Egypt. that's not going to be moved for a long time. For most of the time of the Bible, in fact, for all the time of the Bible, the capital city of Egypt is Zoan, and it will change its name to Tanis. It is right here in this location where Nebuchadnezzar is going to come and kill the Pharaoh and make himself Pharaoh in 607 BC before he captures the southern kingdom and takes Daniel and Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego and a bunch of the others off into exile. He's going to become the Pharaoh of Egypt first. And so that's 110 miles, and Joseph is going to be sold into captivity there. We'll catch that in just a minute. So what do they do? Verse 31 says, so they took Joseph's tunic, and they slaughtered a male goat and dipped. Yes. So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered the male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Can you imagine what that trip was like? Can you imagine? They have sold this. For Reuben, he is humiliated. He is mortified. He's the oldest. He was responsible. But for the others, for Judah and the others, I think they are glad their brother is gone. They're glad their brother is gone. We have found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not. Then he, Jacob, examined it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. I wonder how he knew that. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. The sad part about that is, those boys made that 60-mile trip back to dad, but Joseph was on a caravan that actually came down within about 20 miles of Hebron and then made its way on down to Zoan. It took him 6 days to get there. It's the first place in the scripture where we see the cell of a human being. And Joseph is going to be sold twice. Sold twice. Within 6 days. Now, we know, we don't know for sure, but the selling of human beings as slaves must have already been going on. We wonder how Abraham acquired his slaves, never talked about purchasing them. We wonder how Jacob acquired his slaves, never talked about purchasing them, but now we see here, it must have been going on, or the Ishmaelites and the Midianites would not have agreed to it. So it probably was already a common thing. And so Joseph is taken down to Egypt. When Jacob sees the tunic, here's what he does, verse 34. So Jacob tore his clothes and he put sackcloth on his loins and he mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters, you know it says daughters? All we know about of a daughter is Dinah. We don't know about any other daughters. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have other daughters. Probably what it does mean is he's speaking about the wives of the sons that have married would be considered his daughters. They rose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, surely I will go down to Sheol. Sheol meaning simply the grave in the theology of Jacob. Just going to go to the grave. Going to go to that cave where dad and mom were buried. And I'm going to be buried there. In mourning for my son. So his father wept for him. He's going to grieve for him until the day he dies. Listen, folks. You know, I've been in the ministry more than 40 years now, which means I have lived long enough to see people who have lost their sons or their daughters and never got over it. I've even seen husbands and wives who've lost their spouses and never got over it and never were able to pick up and go on with life. Never. I have seen with my wife's grandfather that when he died, his wife, his spouse, grieved so much over the next year that she died one day after the anniversary of his death, and she was miserable for that year because he was the love of her life. And she grieved and she grieved and she grieved, and not even a visit from the kids and the grandkids and the great-grandkids that used to bring such joy to her brought any joy at all. You see, there's a problem when you make a favorite son a favorite son. Parents should not have favorites. You can't help but have favorites, but the children should never know which one was the favorite. The interesting thing about that is because you can do an irretrievable and unfixable harm, irreparable harm, to those that are not the favorite. And to the favorite. And for those of us who've lived more than 40 years and see this kind of thing happen, we know what happens. The child that did so good in school that we were so proud of many times ends up with an adult life that you think, what in the world happened to them? And the child that you thought that you were not favorable towards, that you never thought would make anything of themselves, they just put the stars in space for you and the moon, hang the moon and the sun because of the things they're doing. And you're so proud of them that just every time you try to button your buttons, they bust off because you're so proud. And you never know what's going to happen to a person. You never know. You never know. You marry them off to somebody you think this is going to be the best marriage in the world, and it turns disastrous. You never know when you say I do what 30 years of marriage is going to end up and look like, or even 5 years of marriage or 2 years of marriage. You have it all planned out in your mind and you have a favorite here and a favorite there. No. Now, that's not to say that you should not be proud of your kids and the kids know that you are proud of them at certain times. Yes. A child should see you proud of a sibling that has done great in a football game or a basketball game, but at the same time, you need to find something to be proud about that child that was watching on at that time when something that they do. You have to be equal with them. It's impossible for you not to have a favorite child. It is impossible. But the problem is you often sometimes select the wrong child to be your favorite child. Sometimes you select the child that doesn't have the abilities that the other, and you put so much emphasis in them because you're trying to help them get along that the other siblings think that they are the favorite child. We shouldn't do that. But Jacob had clearly shown that Joseph was the favorite child, and now he has mourned so long. While Joseph is down in Egypt, they have mourned so long that nothing can console Jacob, and he is saying, I shall go to my grave in mourning. Verse 36 says, meanwhile, I love Moses. He's telling us the story and bringing us back what's going on. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar and Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguards. The year is 2259 years after the creation of Adam. Joseph is 17 years old and he has been sold as a slave to the captain of Pharaoh's bodyguards. He's been sold twice. I want to say to you this so that you'll understand it. There was a prophecy that was given to Abraham. In fact, I have it written there in Genesis chapter 15, verse 13. And God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. Here we have the beginning of that. Abraham's grandson, I should say his great-grandson, is now a slave in a foreign land. The prophecy is in its beginning of being fulfilled. And 22 years after this moment, the whole family of Jacob will move to Egypt. And when they get there, they'll be there for a while. And then the 400 years of enslavement will begin on them. In fact, so much we know about that. We do not know the day or the month that Joseph was sold into slavery. But we know the day and the month that Jacob moved and arrived before Pharaoh in Egypt. You know how we know that? In Exodus chapter 12, verse 40. It says, "Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came about at the end of the 430 years to the very day that all the host of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." We know that they left on the first month, on the 15th day of that their calendar. Now, we call that Nisan the first, but Nisan is a Babylonian name. Those names are not going to be attached to their calendar until after they come back, after Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Cyrus the Great sends them back. They come back with Babylonian names for all their calendar months. The Jews always just called the months 1, 2, 3 through 12. What month is it? 12. What day is it? 15. On the 15th day of the first month, 430 years before they left Egypt, Jacob and his family were before Pharaoh in Egypt to the very day. 1 Kings 6, chapter 6, verse 1 tells us that 480 years to the very day after the children of Israel left Egypt, that Solomon began building the temple in Jerusalem. What day did he begin on? The 15th day of the first month. We know exactly when it happened because it says to the very day. And we can spin that on out. We go down, we add 36 years to Solomon's life for him to die, because he died after 40 years of reigning at the age of 70. He didn't live to be 80, he lived to be 70. And then there are 370 more years of the divided kingdom, the reigns, before Nebuchadnezzar took over. And then there are 70 years of exile after Nebuchadnezzar took over, before Cyrus the Great took over. And then we have to leave the Bible to go get three sets of dates for three Persian kings. And you say, "Jim, how can we trust when we go outside the Bible?" Let me tell you how you and I can trust it. Cyrus the Great became the king of the monarch of Persia in 550 BC. And that Persian monarchy did not end until 1979, when Jimmy Carter was president, and most of us in here lived through that. You know, the Shah of Iran and the Iman that came back and took over when that monarch, and Persia, Iran has a perfect, that is one of the longest monarchies ever to be in the world, was between Cyrus the Great and that last monarch that was taken out, came to America, by the way, if you remember. In 1979, they kept perfect records of their kings, their monarchs, and how long they reigned. And once we do that, we find out exactly when Artaxerxes began his rule and when he decreed for the Jews to go back and to rebuild Jerusalem under with Persian money. And on top of that, Daniel then tells us that from the time of that decree until the birth of Jesus Christ was 483 years, and it turns out to be 4 BC, any way you add it up. The numbers are perfect. The destruction of the temple happens at the right time. The taking over and the many, many Tiki Yusuf Farsi and the you have been weighed in the balance, and the fall of the Babylonian kingdom happens in the exact right year. The years we've told y'all all along, it works out. It works out perfect. And I'm going to show that to you at the end of the book of Genesis. Well, so here we have it. The beginning of the prophecy to Abraham of the 400 years is beginning to start. Lord Jesus, we thank this time to worship you. and to see how you have created us, about things that are right and things that are wrong, that are moral and immoral, of the things that we should do and the things that we should not do, the things that we should do to others and the things we should not do to others. But Lord, also to see how things are in your plan, for even as Joseph said, what these boys intended to do for evil, you were behind it, doing it for good. We praise you for that in your name. Amen and amen.